Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Circle of Insight Foreign Affairs, where you will receive a daily briefing on national security news from around the world. Let's get started. Here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we have a great guest, Dr. Nicholas Dumovich. He's an assistant professor of intelligence studies at the Politics Department of the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. He's also a deacon of the Orthodox Church in America, but he was also in the CIA for 26 years. He was an intelligence analyst and a manager. We're going to learn a lot about him today, as well as China. That's what we're going to be talking about today, espionage, China, and a whole lot more. I can't wait. Before we get started, you know the routine. Share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know we like it. Let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dumovich. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity, Carlos. When you reached out and told me who had been on your program before, I was very impressed and thought, I want to be part of that number.
Oh, thank you very much. We've been really blessed with a lot of great guests, including you now. And this is actually a very serious topic in the sense of China is not going away. If anything, it seems to be getting stronger in its espionage. Before we get to that, because I know we're going to have most of that's going to be that talk. You said you were in intelligence for the CIA for 26 years. Tell us a little bit about some of your roles and what was the most important? Well, I'll ask that later. Tell us about some of your roles.
Sure. I spent 11 years, the last 11 years of my 26-year career as a staff historian. I was on the history staff. I was working for one of your previous guests, Dr. David Robarge, the chief historian. I was his deputy. And among the things that I studied, historians at CIA look at the whole record, the classified record, to try to figure out what happened, you know. My son, you know, when he was 9 years old, I asked him what he thought I did for a living. And he said, you figure out what happened and tell people not to do it again. And there's some truth to that, or we would figure out what happened that went right and why it went well. Our primary audience was the workforce, the cleared workforce. And we would write classified things. One of the projects I got involved in dealt with China. And Chinese operations and our operations against China in the Cold War. And in particular, I focused on a early Cold War mission that went south in a big hurry. And that was an insertion of a bunch of ethnic Chinese that CIA had trained in the Far East going into communist China to collect data, to collect information. That's what we do. And also to be in a position to create some mischief, sabotage, and such. And it was on a resupply flight that a CIA aircraft, it was actually operated by Civil Air Transport, but it belonged to CIA, was shot down because the Chinese had penetrated the operation. They knew the plane was coming in. They shot it down. And the pilots... The two pilots died in that crash, but the two CIA guys in the back survived. And I'll make this long story very short. They basically spent 20 years in Chinese prisons. And so I documented all of that. And then as we did often on the history staff, we've looked for a way to get this out to the general public. This was originally for the workforce, sort of as a warning about being more careful in your planning for covert operations. And so we were able to get it out there. And so if anybody's interested, you can Google my name and China prisoners, or simply the title of the piece, which was Extraordinary Fidelity. We even made a movie about it, again, for internal use only.
Wow.
Somebody put in a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request. Our lawyers said, you know, you can't keep this hidden. And so we released it. And so you can find it on YouTube. Our sort of a history channel documentary style film.
What's it called?
About this. It's called Extraordinary Fidelity.
Extraordinary Fidelity.
Yeah. That was a phrase that was on one of the awards that the men received when they were released. They were released because of the opening to China engineered by Henry Kissinger and President Nixon in the 1970s. And they went on to lead admirable lives. They were not victims of anything. They were very resilient. And so I thought it was a great story. It's now a book in progress that I'm working on, turning my short article on it into something more substantial. So that was my introduction to China. I myself, as an analyst and as a manager of analysts, I worked on other parts of the world, the Soviet Union, the former Soviet republics, Eastern Europe, and then Southeast Asia. But I always knew and had friends among the China analysts, always respected them and learned from them. Today, you know, I'm teaching undergraduates, college kids, about intelligence. And one of the things I try to teach them about is how to think like an analyst, how to look at the world through the eyes of an intelligence officer. And one of the ways we have to sort out what's going on in the world is what kind of countries are there? You know, you can talk about democratic countries. They have democratic forms of government, and non-democratic or anti-democratic countries. We can talk about industrialized countries and poor countries. You know, in the Cold War, we had First World, Third World, Second World was the communist era. But the most useful way of looking at countries, a typology, I think, for an intelligence officer is revisionist states versus status quo states or countries. And status quo countries are countries that are pretty satisfied, content with defending what they have with the status quo, their relations with other countries, the way the map looks. But revisionist states are unhappy. They're unhappy with the map. They're unhappy with their relations, power relations, diplomatic relations with other countries. They want to change things. And in that light, you know, we always talk about the big four troublemakers for U.S. national security: Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Well, they're all revisionist states. They're all unhappy with the map in one sense or another. And of those, China is the most dangerous, has been the most dangerous, I think, since the fall of the Soviet Union, and will continue to be the most dangerous for the foreseeable future, echoing the statement you made at the top of the program here. All of these revisionist states are what we in intelligence call hard targets. They are hard to penetrate. They are hard to collect on. They have pervasive counterintelligence services that they spend a lot of money on. They control the movement of foreigners, surveillance of them, not only foreigners, but their own populations. And we're seeing that now with China and the whole Uyghur population out in Xinjiang province in the Northwest. China in particular has had a rate of increase of spending on internal security that is even higher than the rate of spending on their People's Liberation Army, their military.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just astounding.
Yeah.
So I think the view in U.S. national security circles, and certainly in the intelligence community, is that, you know, everybody knows about the rise of China. China is just doing more and bigger things on the world stage, politically, diplomatically, militarily, economically, right? But this rise of China everybody knows about, I think the more thoughtful people about this say this is just the beginning stages of what China really wants in the end. Their end game is global hegemony. Hegemony is a kind of a standard political science or international relations word, not to mean, you know, occupation or domination per se, but basically that things go China's way, that it is deferred to. Its will generally says what's going to happen.
You don't think that's hyperbolic? That's not hyperbolic at all, is it?
It's a stretch goal of the Chinese. That goal is consistent with everything that we've seen. I mean, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who also had been head of CIA, he said a few years ago that there's nothing that explains the rate of spending that the Chinese military is doing for its military modernization, except for doing aggressive things, like about Taiwan. And I'm very, very concerned about Taiwan. I recently wrote a piece for the National Security Institute at George Mason University on a scenario that is very disturbing. What if Russia and China, who both have what they consider unfinished business to do, Russia with regard to Ukraine, China with regard to Taiwan, what if they colluded? What if they decided to cooperate on the timing? How bad would that screw us up? Really bad.
Very bad, yeah.
The only historical analogy is what historians still call the dual crises of October 1956. You had the Hungarian Revolution and the Soviet suppression of that at the same time as the Mideast War, which was sparked by the English and the French and the Israelis trying to wrest back the Suez Canal from Egyptian leader Nasser. He had nationalized the Suez Canal. And so the only what we know from that is that there was no collusion. However, the Soviet leadership was definitely interested and thought that the timing of their move into Hungary would benefit from the United States being distracted in part by this Suez crisis. So, you know, I can only imagine that they're thinking in these terms now. And if they figure out that there's mutual benefit to that, we could see that. And that is what we call a warning problem, right? In intelligence analysis, you know, we've got the normal kinds of reports that are made, trying to forecast what's going on a daily basis, every couple of weeks, long-term estimates and so forth. But the warning function, that's those people who worry about what's going to happen in the next day or so. That would be of a surprise. And so they're trying to warn of something. They're trying to make it not a surprise. So we're not surprised by something that normally we would be surprised by. It's a really hard thing to do. And when people talk about intelligence failures, they're often talking about warning failures. And so I wrote this piece to kind of highlight this would be a major, you know, twice over dual warning failure if it turns out we wake up tomorrow morning or whenever, and Russia has moved on Ukraine at the same time, more or less, as China has moved on Taiwan. So anyway, that's some current thinking about that. So this rise of China, this desire for global hegemony, is definitely facilitated by Western discord. You know, people in the West are unhappy about economic issues, about government response to the COVID virus, coronavirus, by elections, and particularly the discord within the United States is something that is certainly not, it does not put the brakes on China's aspirations. This appearance of U.S. weakness, our rather ignominious withdrawal suddenly from Afghanistan, our apparent inability to deal with Vladimir Putin. These sorts of things, I think, only encourage the Chinese to get on with their program. So what is their program, right? You mentioned Chinese espionage, right? That's going on. It's been going on for a long time. In 1985, it was discovered that a longtime CIA employee, a guy named Larry Chin, who was a Chinese translator for CIA, he had been working for 50 years for the People's Republic of China.
50 years?
Yeah. Huh. He had inside information. Even though he was just a translator, he had a security clearance, and he had inside information that he provided to the Chinese about the opening to China that the Nixon administration was planning. More recently, yeah, it's just been coming out of the woodwork, all these cases, espionage cases. The first time that the United States arrested a Chinese intelligence officer, somebody who works for their Ministry of State Security, was just 3 years ago. And he had been working with assets to penetrate U.S. defense firms, contractors, and in particular, General Electric. And his thing was to gather aviation technology, jet engine technology for the Chinese. The year before that, a Chinese citizen was arrested when he tried to steal medical technology from a Boston medical firm. Just this month, the FBI arrested a Chinese scientist, somebody who had been recruited by, there's a Chinese program called 1,000 Talents. And what it basically does is it identifies smart technicians and scientists to send to the West to penetrate Western institutions and corporations, gather intelligence, and come back. And that's what this guy was doing. He had worked for Monsanto for about a year. He quit, bought a one-way ticket to Beijing, and the FBI grabbed him at the airport. They found that he had stolen algorithms that have to do with agricultural production improvements. And the list just goes on and on. You know, there's a Chinese telecom company called Huawei. Increasingly, it's looking very clear that it is working as a subsidiary of Chinese intelligence and the military. And some of their officials have been arrested or charged in the U.S. and Poland, for example. You know, clearly, and I'll talk about Huawei a little later. So many people assume that Chinese intelligence, their whole strategy is basically focused on using people of Chinese heritage, Chinese background. And for a long time, that seemed to be true, but it's no longer true. I mean, they still do it. Recently in 2020, a former CIA officer and a case officer, somebody who ran spies, was arrested and sentenced to 19 years in prison for working for Beijing, working for Chinese intelligence. We had noticed that he had retired in 2007, and we realized starting about 2010 that many of our assets, assets are foreigners who work for us to provide information. Many of them were disappearing with no explanation. So it's through this guy, his name is Jerry Lee, Jerry Chung-Shing Lee, a Chinese-American, U.S. citizen, CIA officer, who in his retirement decided to cooperate. He brought out his notebooks, became a security officer for an auction house in Shanghai, started working with the Chinese. And so they learned about our assets, they learned about our case officers, and they learned about how we communicate, the covert communications or COVCOM methodologies that we use. And we think that the Chinese then turned over what they learned about COVCOM to the Russians, because not long after that, we were losing Russian assets as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
I don't have anything encouraging to say here. The news is pretty much all bad. But I do want to emphasize for your listeners, many of whom are probably, if not in clear positions that require security clearances, they probably have some sensitivity to much of their work, that the Chinese are looking for Americans that don't have Asian background. And we saw that for the first time in 2007. It was the first time that the Chinese recruited a U.S. citizen and tried to infiltrate him into the intelligence community of the United States. And this was a kid from Michigan called Glenn Shriver. If people are interested in his story, it's on the internet. The FBI has posted a lot of stuff. He was a student of Chinese language, got a job in Shanghai, and was approached to basically penetrate either the State Department or CIA. He applied to CIA from some source. We realized what was going on, and he basically tripped up in the polygraph. He was convicted. He cooperated fully and only spent 4 years in prison. But it, you know, basically ruined his life. Others, in 2018, the FBI arrested a guy named Ron Hansen. This is not Robert Hansen, the FBI special agent who was working for Moscow. This is Ron Hansen, who is a DIA officer, Defense Intelligence, who, after he retired, he started going to defense conferences, reestablishing contacts with people on the inside in a way that made them feel uncomfortable. He was able to buy up classified software, and all the time he's working for Beijing. About the same time, you've got Kevin Mallory. Again, no Asian background. He was a China expert at CIA. He worked for DIA for a time, and then he was a CIA contractor. And he passed classified information to his handlers in the Ministry of State Security. They first approached him on LinkedIn. Now, any of you who have a LinkedIn account and you've had some interesting jobs, jobs that deal with classified material or just high tech, you know, be very careful if you get a invitation to a conference in Shanghai sponsored by some Chinese think tank. Well, that's how Kevin Mallory got sucked in. His contact at this Chinese think tank was actually an officer of the Ministry of State Security, the Chinese External Service. And we've seen this a lot. There was a major story in France recently where it was found that Chinese intelligence was using LinkedIn to, and I don't mean to pick on LinkedIn, I have an account and I find it very useful. They use all the social media that they can. But in France, on LinkedIn, they were targeting people who were in government, had been in government, or in sensitive corporate positions in the nuclear industry, in shipbuilding, in aviation, and so forth. All with this pitch to, you know, come and, you know, give a lecture. We'll pay you for this. I myself have been pitched on LinkedIn in this way. I'm not surprised. I'd be surprised if it didn't happen. But it just shows how pervasive the attempts are. And it's not just CIA and DIA. The FBI has had some very embarrassing stories where in one in which a couple of their special agents, who they thought that they were running this Chinese immigrant who was a businesswoman, and each of them had a sexual relationship with her. And she was actually working for Beijing, so they thought that they were getting information from her. They might have, but it was all disinformation. Meanwhile, she's searching their briefcases and learning from them all about FBI internal organization, counterintelligence methodologies, personnel involved in counterintelligence. They were a gold mine for her.
Old honey trap.
The honey trap, exactly. That is alive and well. At the State Department, they've had their problems with recruitments of State Department employees by Chinese intelligence. Recently, a woman named Candace Claiborne, she was arrested for having these ties with these Chinese who were Chinese intelligence, gave her gifts, asked her for information. And she was charged with not reporting. You have to report all such foreign interactions. She didn't report them. She didn't report the gifts. And so she spent some time in jail. And she was providing them with internal policy papers, for example, on U.S. trade policy with China, something the Chinese, of course, would want, be happy to pay for. The United States Navy has had its issues, you know, with attempts to recruit people, but also hacking into their systems and hacking into defense contractors who that are working on naval weapons systems. So it's all, you know, very, very much an attempt to gather information across the board. The Center for the for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, Washington think tank, did a study a couple years back on Chinese espionage cases. And these are the only the ones we know about, right? Sure, by definition, yeah. We don't know about the ones that we haven't discovered. So they identified over almost a 20-year period from 2000 to into late 2019, 137 cases. 137 cases.
137?
Yeah, and I believe that's probably the tip of the iceberg. Okay, most of those, in fact, three quarters of them were in the second half of that 20-year period. So the trend is accelerating, okay? And they had some interesting percentages on what the aim was. 46% of these cases were to acquire commercial technologies, high-tech stuff, for commercial use, right? Because in China, national security is also a matter of foreign economic relations. So 46% to acquire commercial technology, 36% to acquire military technology. And of course, they'll buy anything and re-engineer it. And 18% to acquire information from U.S. agencies or U.S. people. So it's a three-prong, you know, not quite equal attempt to basically suck up anything that they might find useful. And Chinese collection, aside from the espionage, which is a specialized form of collection using human means, their broadband collection is just disturbing. You've heard of the various major data breaches.
A lot of them.
Yeah, in 2014, that was a disturbing one. The Office of Personnel Management has files on Americans who apply for, among other things, security clearances. Well, that hack, which was attributed to the Chinese military, disclosed the security information. These are called SF-86, Standard Form 86. Anybody who's ever had a clearance with the feds has got to fill out this long thing. Now it's online, of course, when they do it. But 21 million Americans, their security information was hacked. And that includes 4 million federal employees. This lets the Chinese know who's got security problems, who might have some drug problems, debt problems. Because you have to disclose all that when you are going for a security clearance. In 2013, there was the Equifax, right, the big credit rating company, credit information on 145 million Americans was compromised.
Remember that. Yeah.
Again, attributed to the Chinese. What do they want with this? Well, it makes it easier if you're lining up prospects to work for you, either willingly or through blackmail, if you know something about the buying habits, the debt of Americans. And there are others. The Marriott Hotel complex, they were hacked into. There have been other prominent ones. So I think anyone who has had a white-collar job, essentially, probably has data that is now residing in China. And that includes, disturbingly, our DNA. Several years ago, the major U.S. company in gene sequencing and research was bought by a Chinese company, which means that it is under the control of the Chinese government, because, you know, I could cite for you the Chinese laws that require all Chinese companies to cooperate with the government. As of a couple years ago, at least 23 U.S. companies that deal with DNA data have some association with China. The experts that I read say that China's hoovering up, just sucking up any foreign DNA it can access. And of course, it's doing DNA profiles for its entire population as well. This is really kind of disturbing. I mentioned Huawei. Huawei is the, I don't know if it is any longer, for up to a few years ago, it was the world's largest telecommunications provider of equipment and channels and so forth. Well, it's been a recognized threat to U.S. national security for many years. You know, the government under President Trump banned it from U.S. telecommunications systems. Some of our allies, like Australia and Britain, have banned it from their systems. And this is good, but, you know, and this is a case where firm U.S. action to basically boycott Huawei has done some damage to it. But the efforts keep going on. You know, we could talk about China's sort of soft power efforts to influence our way of thinking about China through these Confucius Institutes.
That's right.
You've probably heard about it with China. Again, it doesn't appear to be the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party, which is the real power for everything. But there are enough links that you can see where the real power is. China then offers to a U.S. university a Confucius Institute, a place that China will pay for, that students can learn Chinese, listen to lectures about Chinese culture and everything. And the problem is, once a Confucius Institute is ensconced on a campus, then they try to throw their weight around. And in one case, for example, a university had invited the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibet, and the Confucius Institute tried to shut it down. They are working for the Chinese Communist Party. It's pretty clear. And fortunately there, the exposure of this has led to many of these Confucius Institutes simply being shut down. They're not as prevalent as they used to be. But it's just another way of China trying to extend its influence, gather information on its path towards global hegemony, where it doesn't have to worry about competitors. It's not going to be directing traffic in anywhere other than in Beijing, but, you know, it can influence all sorts of things going on. Let me quote for you, I think, a couple important perspectives from U.S. intelligence, because that's what this is about. Michael Hayden, unique as the former director of the National Security Agency and a former director of the CIA as well, a career intelligence officer, Air Force officer, really a deep thinker, strategic thinker on things. He wrote in his memoir, "As a professional, I stand in awe at the depth, breadth, and persistence of China's intelligence efforts against the United States." I think it's very significant. And Michael Morell, former acting CIA director, he now has a, in retirement, he has a very good podcast on CBS called Intelligence Matters. And he wrote a very good book about the global war on terror from an intelligence point of view. He wrote that the most formidable challenge that America faces is how to respond to the rise of China. We have not yet found a long-term strategy, he says, but the status quo is not an option. Because every day China grows in confidence that it can go its own way. He goes on to say that we may have to think of ourselves as Britain after World War II and just accept ourselves as number two in the world. It's a disturbing thought because we Americans always consider ourselves to be preeminent number one. So anyway, I've talked a lot, Carlos. I'm happy to take questions.
I got a bunch of them.
Sure.
It was great, though. It was really a nice introduction, and even a lot of stuff that people probably have never heard of. There's so much in there, and it's amazing because that's probably the tip of the iceberg. By the way, folks, we're talking to Dr. Nicholas Dumovic. It's Dumovic, if you want to get more insight and more information about him and what he's up to. He's always up to something. So it's great stuff, so definitely want to check it out. I guess my first question, I want to go back to the history aspect of it, sure. Which was interesting because it reminded me a little bit of Stalin and Hitler and how they couldn't get along, and the containment strategy that America was following at one point to try to stop the spread of communism. And we kind of had that, you know, we got lucky in a sense that China at that point wasn't really working with Russia because they had their own agendas. They had their own versions of communism in a way.
Right.
And thankfully those three didn't collaborate because I think the world would be a very different place. There's always a book out there that I always like. I can't remember who wrote it. It was called What If? And they looked at all the battles of history and what if it flipped around the other side.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Alternative history. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it really is. And you wonder, but do they still, is that the same reason today they haven't collaborated, or are they much closer to the potential of collaborating?
I think they're closer. And I think it's because they are not ideological competitors as they were during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union, which arrogated it to itself, the leadership of international communism, and kind of looked down upon the Chinese communists, that didn't bode well for good relations. And yeah, I think you're right that it's to our advantage that there was a split, the Soviet Chinese or the Sino-Soviet split. We benefited from that. But now it's much more what the international specialists call realpolitik. You know, this is just power relations. And both Moscow and Beijing, I think, recognize that they have a mutual benefit in doing some cooperation against the United States. We know that their military cooperation is increasing. They're doing exercises together. They're sharing information. They've been engaged in talks about what's going on in Kazakhstan, you know, the unrest there, which led the Russians to send, they say, 2,500 troops. So, and there are other areas in which they can potentially collaborate, in space, for example. So I actually think that the potential for collusion between Russia, or I should say Moscow and Beijing, is greater now than it was during the Cold War. During the Cold War, by the way, we had some cooperation with the Chinese against the Soviet Union. You know, we had some limited intelligence sharing, even to the point of, you know, the Chinese allowing some of our people to be in China to monitor what the Soviets were doing in terms of missile testing. That has long gone away. And now, if anything, we're seeing it replaced by a closer, not, I wouldn't say warm, but closer relations between the Russians and the Chinese.
I don't know if you're a comic book fan or not, but it always reminds me of when the villains collaborate together. And again, folks, I'm only talking about the governments here, not the people of these countries. There's a lot of people who are wonderful from these countries, but the government is usually the problem. But sometimes it reminds me of that, right? When you have the Joker working with the Penguin, trying to overtake the city, and Batman's got to deal with it. And much more of a headache when you have two or three of them. And these are much more dire consequences than that. You know, I wanted to ask a little bit about Xi Jinping. In America, right, every time we have a new president, it's always the same thing. Are they the ones who are really running the show? Or is he a puppet? It doesn't seem, I don't know. Is it the same for Xi Jinping? Is he a puppet? Is it, who's really pulling the strings? Is it a cadre? What's going on over there?
I understand from the real China experts that he's the real deal in terms of having a grip on the Chinese Communist Party, which itself has a grip on all of Chinese government and society. Nothing happens without the Chinese communists allowing it. Or if something does happen that they don't know about, they can quickly swoop in. All the security forces ultimately report to the Chinese Communist Party. And there was some speculation that at the last top party meeting that was held in the past few months, that Xi would be challenged by people on his economic policies, for example. Well, that didn't happen. And if anything, you know, he looks like, well, he has put himself forward as one of the great leaders of Chinese history, including, you know, putting himself in the same level as Mao Zedong, who was a great revolutionary.
That's gutsy.
Great, I mean, significant revolutionary leader and a mass murderer too. But so that is kind of disturbing. I mean, there's, you know, Xi Jinping thought, you know, like we used to have Mao's thought, the little red book, and so forth. So I don't think there is any challenge internally to Xi's power.
Interesting. It's just kind of weird. That'll lead me to another question in a bit about the media's role too. I'd like to get your take on that a little bit, but not right now. I guess my next question is, you mentioned the EU, you mentioned France's issue at LinkedIn, which is actually a really big issue. I think we talked about on the phone last time a few weeks ago about the FBI's video showing how a professor got solicited, I think, by China, how dangerous that can be, which right. I'm surprised hasn't hit mainstream. I really wish it did. I think it would teach a lot of people things. But I guess my question would be, how are they doing? Do you know, are they responding better than we are in preventing Chinese espionage attacks from happening, dealing with China diplomatically, or are they in the same boat we are, or does it vary? I know there's a lot of questions there.
Yeah, it's hard for me to evaluate the overall effort. I know that episodically, anecdotally, that there are individual moves against Chinese representatives. When Poland arrested a official of the Huawei telecommunications company for colluding, actually trying to get secrets from Polish intelligence officer, who was arrested as well. Denmark has made efforts. The Netherlands, I think, kicked out Chinese who were trying to set up a Confucius Institute. So we do seem to have some degree of awareness of an overall Western problem. I think all these countries are well aware of it. But your question also includes the question, you know, couldn't we do better in cooperating, showing a united front? And definitely we can. We have on Huawei. We are, I think, to some degree on the problem with the Uyghurs who are being suppressed in northwest China. The Beijing Olympics is coming up, and there is sort of a somewhat of a unified front there in terms of, you know, not sending our diplomats to observe the games, but we're still participating in it. So that's a mixed message. We could do better.
You know, it's interesting because I know when I was talking to some of the individuals and the CIA intelligence individuals, has spoken to some in the cyber media world. They're all very concerned. And I don't know if we talked about this or not. I've only heard one person kind of contradicted to a degree. He was more nuanced of a contradiction, that they're really afraid of social media, the intelligence here, the individuals I was talking to, because they said it's gone too Wild West-ish. They're really having a hard time controlling the propaganda that goes on, because there's obviously a PSYOP operation happening here with China and Russia and Iran and North Korea.
They're all doing it, yes.
They're all doing it. And they said that we've lost a lot of it because they're influencing movements, they're creating dissension and things of that nature. What's your take on that? I'm not sure if you saw much on that.
Well, it's not really the province of somebody who was in a intelligence service that looked basically at the rest of the world. But I do understand that FBI is looking at this problem a great deal. That in the what's the new agency, the infrastructure, cyber infrastructure agency and security agency, they're looking at this. But yeah, all these countries are doing it. I want to believe that people in America are savvier now after the events of the last 2 years, politically, that we're less gullible to be influenced by people who, you know, claim to be good Americans, but they're actually PLA, Chinese military people in a particular building that we've identified in Beijing, trying to influence us. So that's not a very good answer to your question. I just don't have my finger on that pulse.
You think, well, I guess in your opinion, well, this would be difficult. I was going to ask you, because I know there's a lot of changes now that are really hunting them down with Facebook and Section 230 and all these things are really trying to slam that shut. But LinkedIn's another one, as you mentioned, and LinkedIn is a great account. And I think that's what makes it even more dangerous is it's a very serious account. So yeah. It's a lot harder to determine who's credible and who's not, because a lot of people are.
That's right. Well, and all these efforts, you know, they play on our vanity, frankly. You know, when I get an invitation to go give a lecture in Shanghai, you know, part of me wants to believe that somebody would actually want to hear me so much that they would fly me out there. And, you know, if that doesn't survive a few seconds scrutiny and cold logic. No. And whether it's, you know, they're coming at you with appeal to your vanity. You know, we've talked about a honey trap. Well, that's, you know, if you don't look like a movie star and you're an adult male, generally speaking, you know, the women are not going to come on to you. You want to believe that they do for your own sake, right? But actually they're after what you know. And that has happened again and again in U.S. counterintelligence history, where males are deceived that this sweet young thing is really interested in them, and it's not. So I hope that we are smarter and realize that these efforts are playing on our vanities, playing on our biases, our political stances, telling us what we want to hear and inflaming it. You know, that's something we have to be aware of as a society.
I have to say, it always amazes me. We have honey trap situations here. I mean, we've known them for so many years, decades, and you kind of figure you work in intelligence. As you said, you're 60 and this one's 25, 30. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. We always want to believe that we're the exception to the rule that applies to everyone else.
There you go. I mean, I don't know whatever happened with the one with the California and the politician over here. He had somebody working with him and they thought she was a Chinese spy. And I don't know whatever ended up happening with that. That was an interesting one too. And it puts a lot of problems, but out of curiosity, do we know how much on average they pay these individuals? Or is that something we don't want to even say?
No, actually, some of this is public knowledge. You know, I mentioned the case of that former Chinese language student from Michigan, Glenn Shriver. I think over the course of he was being groomed over 18 months, 2 years. I think they paid him a total of $70,000, which, you know, if you're a single young man starting out at that time, this is, you know, not quite 20 years ago. That could seem like a lot of money. Other cases where somebody, the State Department person who was being wined and dined and given gifts and everything, she was looking to make an extra $20,000 a year. We're not talking about huge amounts. However, in some cases, like the Kevin Mallory and the Ron Hansen cases, both these guys were in debt. They were in danger of losing their houses, and that was part of their motivation to seek another form of income by betraying their country. And so those figures might be more, because, you know, the intelligence recruitment has been likened to fly fishing. You know, you want to provide what's going to hook the fish, but no more. And so, you know, they will try to appeal to your sense of indebtedness, or the give gifts, you know, that will appeal to your kids or something like that. They do study their subjects.
I guess that's a good segue to my other question, which was, you mentioned the DNA, but do we know what they're up to with the DNA?
That is, we can only speculate. I mean, if you think of it in the broad spectrum of collection activities, okay, they're getting credit data, they're getting security info data, DNA data. What I think the Chinese do is they collect because it's there. They collect for the sake of collecting. They're making an investment in collecting because, you know, that kind of collection and that kind of storage is cheap, right? And what they're doing is hoping that someday it might be useful. We might be able, okay, we've identified through this security breach a particular individual who might have some troubles in the workplace, might be discontented. The credit data then comes in. Okay, he's in debt, you know, might be in danger of losing his house. If we have the DNA data as well, we might see if there's a medical condition that we could exploit, we being Chinese intelligence, right? I'm not quite sure, but that's, I'd speculate along those lines. It's just another piece of the puzzle that when you're trying to influence or recruit a particular individual, if you already have that information in the bank, it's another datum that you can use to try to get what you want from that person.
By the way, folks, there's a podcast I do called Cybercrime Podcast. You can look that up, because that was my next question coming up to Dr. Dumovich. It happens all the time. It's constant. People don't think it happens because it's out of sight, out of mind. But it really, I mean, I just read yesterday it was a Japanese Panasonic was hit by a cyber attack. The schools in the U.S., I think there's 30,000 of them that were hit, K-12. But, you know, obviously, if you don't hear it or see it in the major news, nobody thinks it's happening, but it's happening all the time.
Yeah, and not all of it related to foreign countries. Some of it is
true too.
People, criminal activity, people just making mischief. Sometimes, however, the hacks are probes. And again, it's this thinking that we're going to make an investment now for the future. And so we've seen Iran has done this. We think Russia as well and China have making probes to see if you can hack into a hospital's system and maybe flicker the lights just to see if you can do it. Or there was a dam in upstate New York that was hacked into. And at the time, it was actually off the web because of maintenance. But somebody tried to open and close the gates on this dam. Right. So I think there's some testing going on.
That's interesting. Again, folks, it's cybercrime. You can check it out. The only reason I did the podcast is because I wanted to keep it into the sight of people, because it's out of sight, out of mind kind of thing again. And it's interesting. I talked to a hacker by the name of Alyssa Knight. I think they would term her as a white hat hacker. And
who does she work for?
I don't know anymore. I can't remember. I think she works for herself. Okay. She was recruited by a couple of agencies, three-letter ones. But she also worked for the Israeli defense. But she was telling me some of the organizations, like the police departments, would hire her to hack into their police cars. So she would sit in a hotel room and hack from across the street and turn the cars off. Oh. That's crazy stuff.
I have heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, just insane stuff. But I guess it goes back to my other points I mentioned with the media and with the lack of out of sight, out of mind, which I know they can't cover everything, so I get it. But the media also is responsible for how we perceive the world and things of that nature. And you mentioned earlier about China really trying to make themselves be the major player. How much are they digging, or are they enjoying some of the things that are happening now in the U.S., this kind of anti-Americanism that we sometimes see out there, this kind of we're at fault for everything. And China, of course, takes no responsibility for anything.
Right.
So they always keep themselves up in the pedestal. Do you see that being a social issue that they can exploit?
I'm not quite sure, because, you know, I think the Chinese may well be content to let the Russians meddle, as they have in our politics and societal discussions. But I think the Chinese are very quick to use that against us. You know, we'll bring up the plight of the Uyghurs who are repressed in Xinjiang province, and they'll bring up George Floyd, you know, and what people say about that. Not that that has been manipulated. I think it has been exacerbated probably by outside actors. So they'll take the real divisions in our society as they are being made even worse by outside actors, and they'll fling it back at us for diplomatic reasons. So I'm not quite sure. I'd be more concerned about influence activities like the Confucius Institutes, or if there were friendly U.S. media outlets that were basically giving China a pass. I don't think that is happening, because the Chinese themselves have been very aggressive in their external activities. They've been brutal in their internal activities. Everybody knows about Xinjiang. Everybody knows about Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody knows about Tiananmen and the attempts to memorialize that democracy movement, and how the Chinese authorities just shut all that down. So I don't think anybody is fooled by the Chinese anymore. So that's not a battle they can win, I think.
I think you're right. I think the prior administration really hammered them for the 4 years, right, and reputation-wise. And I think it rubbed off on a lot of people. And then the current administration didn't seem to back off on it. It didn't seem to try to change gears, didn't go as hard, but kind of kept the line of, yeah, you know, he's kind of right.
It was nice to see a bipartisan foreign policy, because that suggests that it's on the right track. And it
exactly
is.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see that, because I really didn't know which way it was going to go. And it just kind of, okay, he hasn't changed much on this. And everybody kind of feels the same. Yeah, we've got trouble here. It's interesting. My last question now. I hope I can keep you here all day. But I interviewed, I can't remember his name, might be better that way, but it was a professor I had a while back ago. It's like 4 years ago, I think, or three. We talked about a book he wrote. And we were talking about, and I think at the time, he believed the significance of financial interdependence that we have with these countries. And he thought, you know, people won't want to lose all the prosperity that they have if they start messing around with things and taking advantage and exploiting people and things of that nature, almost like a game theory kind of way, or a prisoner's dilemma, I guess, which is the best outcome? What do you say? What do you don't say? I'm kind of maybe exploiting those two, I mean, exaggerating those two, but, and he was saying that this is what kept the world more peaceful in his mind, or a few years back, that everybody connected to each other financially seems to keep everybody at bay. But it doesn't seem that that's holding water as much.
Yeah, I think in that earlier mindset, there has to be a agreed commitment to the system. In other words, to get back to my opening statement, you know, pretty much that works among status quo powers, status quo countries. But if there is a discontent, if there is a desire to revise the status quo, then people are not going to play by the rules. And that is the major sort of soundbite kind of distillation of the complaint that most countries have against China. They're not playing by the rules, whether it's with the South China Sea or its agreement to keep Hong Kong as, you know, one country, two systems. Well, that's gone away. And so forth. They're not playing by the rules. And this is what the United States, I think this administration is continuing the previous administration's policy of calling the Chinese on this. And I think it's necessary. And I hope that, you know, the democratic status quo countries of the world can continue to cooperate and hold the line. China could be such a marvelous contributor to world prosperity and peace if it were a status quo country. But, you know, its ideology, remember, it's still a communist dominated system, and that inherently means that they're not happy with things the way they are. They have to be revolutionary, they have to change things. Until China discards communism for the bankrupt ideology it is, I'm afraid it will always be a problem.
I guess I lied. One more question. There's the theory of Thucydides' trap. Are we in that mess now?
I know Graham Allison has written about that. You'll have to remind me what specifically that is.
You have more tension when you have a country that's coming up in power, like China has over the last few decades, and then all of a sudden it challenges the existing power.
Yeah, I think there's something true. That's a rewording of my dichotomy between revisionist powers and status quo powers. So, you know, I think it refers to the city-state of Athens being a status quo power. Sparta did not like the status quo and wanted to change it. And that's true. When a country is coming up, is rising, then its own expectations are also expanding. And I think that it's absolutely right that that is a dangerous place to be in. There has to be restraint. There has to be a commitment to some status quo. That's a problem with Russia. You know, not happy with the status quo after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, not happy with the status quo of Ukraine being an independent country that, okay, it has some Russians living there, but it's an independent country. Not happy with borders as they have been set. And
I think I like yours. I like the revisionist status quo concept because it makes it simple. And I know life is complicated, but still, sometimes it's simpler. Again, folks, we talked to Dr. Nicholas Dumovic, Dujmovic. Go make sure you follow him. Great insight. You can follow it. You can actually go to politics.cua.edu/faculty to get more insight on him. Dr. Dumovic, anywhere else you want to send them, or is that good? Or
That'll work. I'm also on LinkedIn, but I'm on no other social media by design.
Yeah, and be careful if you offer him a speaking engagement, but he's going to be a little leery. Thank you so much, Dr. Dumovic, for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great insight. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Hey, remember, share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know, we like it. Stay safe out there.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.